Welcome and thanks for joining Pastor Rick Warren. For a transcript and outline of this message, visit saddlebackresources.com. Let's join Pastor Rick.
Every year we choose a theme for the new year, and the year for 2012 is going to be the year of Scripture engagement. It's part of our Decade of Destiny plan, where we're going to look at how the Word of God applies to each of those seven key areas of our life: physically, emotionally, relationally, spiritually, financially, mentally. We're looking at those seven different key areas and how the Word of God applies. And in January, we're going to kick off the new year with a series called 40 Days in the Word. I'm very, very excited about it. Probably the second most I've ever been excited about anything since 40 Days of Purpose, because I want you to know how to study the Bible. And during 40 Days in the Word, we're going to look at how do you study the Bible to make decisions? How do you study the Bible to get comfort when you need it? How do you study the Bible to get guidance? How do you study the Bible to help somebody else? We're going to look at all these different, how the Bible applies to our life. But before we can do 40 Days in the Word, starting in January, we need to stop and ask the question, how do we know we can trust the Bible? Because if you can't trust it, why should you even worry about it? Why should you even study it? Why should you read it? Why should you look at it if you don't know that it's trustworthy? This weekend, we're going to have five leading Bible scholars from all over the world that are coming to speak to us on this very issue of how do we know we can trust the Bible? And they're each going to look at it from a different angle, like the many facets on a diamond. Now, to kick us off in this first service, Dr. John Dixon has come all the way from Sydney, Australia, to be here with us this weekend. Now, John Dixon is a historian. He is a Bible scholar. He is an author. He's written 15 different books. In fact, some of these books, I'm just going to read, Humilitas, Life with Jesus, The Christ Files, Jesus, A Short Life. He's going to be out on the patio signing books. I'm going to be out there with him signing his books. I am going to be out there. If you want to get a Christmas gift, this would be, some of his books would be great. But John is the director of the Center for Public Christianity. And he's written in secular papers, and he's, you know, been in all of the media. But he's primarily known as the Senior Research Fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Australia's Macquarie University. A great Christian, a wonderful leader, and a Bible scholar. Would you give a rousing Saddleback welcome to Dr. John Dixon from Sydney, Australia? Yeah!
I'd love one of my books signed by Pastor Rick. It'd make them even more expensive. Now, I was told that it's been about 10 years since you've had an Australian in the pulpit. So what I'll do is start really slowly for you, just because I know your funny accent makes it difficult for you to follow me. And then when I see that you're no longer squinting at me, then I'll pick up to a normal Australian pace. Sound all right? Well, as you can see, my topic is why historians take the Gospels seriously. And one of the most enjoyable things I do in my life outside of the academic context is run a short course for skeptics and inquirers into the life of Jesus Christ, just in my lounge room, just part of our little church ministry. And over the 5 or 6 weeks, we ask all sorts of questions, we follow the Gospel of Luke, and normally the first couple of sessions are really quiet affairs, because everyone in the lounge room is worried that maybe the person opposite them knows more than I do. So they keep quiet. And I'm happy just to keep on talking and wait till sessions 3 or 4 before the questions come out. But about 7 or 8 years ago, I noticed a dramatic shift. Session 1, I had just started to explain that Christianity revolves around the person of Jesus, when someone said, "Excuse me, how do we know anything about Jesus?" Another one said, "Did Jesus write something for himself?" And before I'd given an answer, they started to say, "Who wrote the Bible? How long after Jesus? What's the archaeological record?" And on like this. Now, never before had I had so many history-style questions in one session, let alone the very first session of this course into the life of Jesus. And I began to think to myself, am I experiencing what you might call a Da Vinci Code factor? You know, it coincided with the release of this phenomenally successful book, and I thought maybe the Da Vinci Code has interested people, has maybe made them a little more skeptical. Since then, of course, there's been a whole host of different books and videos asking these skeptical questions about the Christian faith. National Geographic had the apparent discovery of a gospel written by the betrayer of Jesus, Judas. Not to be outdone, the Discovery Channel had a multi-million dollar documentary where they claimed that they may have found the actual tomb of Jesus, and there were some bones still in the bone box. Bishop John Shelby Spong's written a book, the new atheist Richard Dawkins and so on, all asking serious historical questions. So I want tonight to try and offer you just six things that every skeptic, spectator, and firm believer ought to know about the Gospels. Why, in particular, historians, and I mean secular historians, still take the Gospels reasonably seriously. The first thing I want to say is that skeptics may rule the headlines, but not the academy. Skeptics may rule the headlines, but not the academy. I think it's important for people to understand that scholarship really falls along three points of a continuum. On what you might call the left margin, and I don't mean that necessarily in its political left sense, but on the left margin are what you might call skeptical scholars, who just ply the scholarly trade in order to debunk the New Testament and the Gospels in particular. On the opposite wing, on the right fringe, you might say, are what you might call apologetic scholars. These are scholars with great PhDs from good universities, but they ply the scholarly craft in order to defend the Bible. And they do us a great service. But the thing I want to point out to you is that the vast majority of scholars fall in the middle, what you might call mainstream scholarship. Mainstream scholarship is interested neither in debunking the faith nor in proving every detail. They just get on with studying the New Testament and the Gospels in particular, the way we might study some other first century text. This is the vast majority of scholarship, actually. Now, although the media has a lot to say from the skeptical fringes, almost nothing from the apologetic wing, the mainstream scholars hardly ever get a hearing, for the simple reason that their work is too careful, nuanced, detailed, sophisticated, and boring for people who write headlines to be interested. And you can understand, a headline like "Jesus overturned first century dining laws" is hardly going to excite a newspaper editor. Do you agree? Even though virtually everyone writing professionally on this topic would agree with that as an historical statement. But I can tell you, "Jesus was gay" is a headline that a newspaper editor will want to publish. And in fact, this is actually an Australian headline from one of our newspapers. It got published even though it was based on nothing more than the musings of a theology student who was a gay activist and did some astrological readings on Jesus and came up with the proposal that maybe he was gay. Why is it important to know this? For the simple reason that when you hear the next thing coming from the media about the discovery of this or the debunking of that, just take a deep breath. Remind yourself you're probably hearing from the tiny little margin of skeptical scholars. Mainstream scholarship doesn't work like that. The second thing I want to say tonight, the second of six things, is very simple. Non-Christian sources confirm the basic data of the Gospels. Some of you will already know this. By a happy accident of history, Jesus is mentioned in a number of ancient historical writings, just in passing, from non-Christians. This is nowhere near as likely as you might imagine, because Although we think of Jesus as the founder of the world's largest faith, let alone the Lord of the universe, in his day, he would hardly have registered a blip on the Greco-Roman radar. And yet, he appears in 11 non-Christian references from antiquity. The 11 texts discussed in the academic literature are from Thallus, Marabar Serapion, Tacitus, Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, Lucian of Samosata, Celsus, 2 from Josephus, and 2 in the Talmud. Now, those of you who are furiously writing notes, I'm sure there are going to be far more detailed notes made available. The most important of these 11 texts, because they are not all of equal value, are, number one, Tacitus, the greatest of ancient Rome's historians. If you know anything about the emperors of Rome, Nero, Caligula, and so on, you got it from Tacitus. Or at least your high school ancient history teacher got it from Tacitus, hopefully. And Tacitus confirms Jesus' execution under Pontius Pilate. The second important ancient text from a non-Christian is Marabar Serapion, writing from prison, refers to Jesus as a wise king martyred by his own people, but who is still remembered. And the third most important references come from Josephus, who mentions Jesus on 2 occasions. On one occasion, he confirms that Jesus was a famous teacher and healer and that he was executed under Pontius Pilate. And in another passing reference, he says that Jesus had a brother called James who was likewise executed and that Jesus was known by the title Christ. My point here is very simple. It's that Jesus' existence, his fame as a teacher and reputed healer, his crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, and the fact that he went by the title Christ would be regarded as beyond reasonable doubt by virtually all professional historians in universities around the world. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that I don't think you would find a professional historian in any reputable university in the world who thinks these core facts are not, in fact, facts. What a contrast, then, with our new atheist friends, Richard Dawkins, Michel Onfray, Christopher Hitchens, who go so far as to even question the existence of Jesus. They all say you can't even decide whether Jesus lived. And Richard Dawkins says that a serious historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all, as has been made by Professor G.A. Wells of London University. Now, when you read that in his book, The God Delusion, you think, wow, London University, it's an important British school. This must mean something. What Dawkins doesn't tell us is that G.A. Wells is professor of German language at the University of London. Now, no offense to people who speak German, they tend to be bright. But being a professor of German language does not give you credentials to write a book on history, the history of Jesus. Yes, he wrote a popular book on Jesus, claiming that Jesus didn't live. But can you imagine if I made some outrageous scientific claim and then cited as my sole authority a professor of music? You would think something fishy is going on. Something fishy is going on in the new atheism. It's becoming a kind of new dogmatism. Thirdly, the alleged bias of the Gospels doesn't trouble historians at all. I had a highly intelligent woman ask me some years ago to list the sources of our knowledge of Jesus. I went through the Greek and Roman and Jewish sources. I thought I'd start there. She was nodding happily. And then I started to list the New Testament sources, the sources written by Christians about Jesus as historical evidence. And she stopped me and she said, "You can't use those." I said, "Why on earth not?" She said, "Because they were written by religious people, they don't count." She somehow got it into her head that religious commitment meant that these writings cannot possibly be regarded as historical writings as well. But this is very far from the truth. The religious nature of the New Testament in no way diminishes the value of the New Testament as historical sources. In my own Department of Ancient History, in a state university, Macquarie University, the New Testament is studied as a real first century text. Now, of course, historians take the Christian perspective into account when they read the Gospels. Of course. But that's no different from when we read Tacitus. We take the Roman imperial bias into account. And when we read Josephus, we take the Jewish perspective into account as well. Taking perspectives into account is what we do in history. It doesn't diminish the value of the New Testament records. In fact, the scholars in ancient history departments around the world do not place the Gospels in a category called religious and then leave them alone. They treat them with some respect, actually. In fact, I would go so far as to say that universally, the Gospels are regarded as the earliest, most plentiful, most important sources for our knowledge of the historical Jesus. This is taken so seriously that I've actually, this year, been teaching a course in the Jewish Studies Department of Sydney University on the life of Jesus. The Jewish Studies Department, with an Orthodox Jewish professor. But because Jesus is a real live figure of first century history, it has to be taught from a historical perspective. Let me turn to the fourth thing I want to say tonight, that you need to have up your sleeve when you meet a skeptical person. And if you are a skeptical person, you need to confront. The New Testament is a collection of sources. The New Testament is a collection of sources. Although it's in a single volume today, you know, you can turn to the whole New Testament in a volume. It's got a contents page, right? You know, the contents page wasn't divinely inspired. You know, that was added more recently. Don't get me started about the chapter headings and the anyway, no, we won't go there. So originally, these documents, they were composed and circulated independently of each other. And then they brought into what we call a book many, many years after they were first composed. So for instance, Paul, the writer of the epistles of Paul in the New Testament, didn't know the content of the Gospel of Mark. This is agreed upon by scholars working in the field. And the author of Mark did not know the content of the epistles of Paul. So here are two sources. Ah, but now you find them in one book together. To give you another example, John didn't know the content of the Gospel of Matthew. He didn't actually know what was in this Gospel. And Matthew didn't know the written Gospel of John. Of course, they knew each other, but they didn't write in collusion with each other. And this is agreed upon by skeptical scholars even around the world. Then there are even sources, according to most mainstream scholars, within the Gospels. They call them QL, SQM. I mean, it's terribly nerdy and they're not very inventive titles. Some Christians are sort of uncomfortable with the notion that, say, Luke used prior sources to write his Gospel of Luke. And whether or not we accept that Luke used prior sources, the thing I'm trying to say is that mainstream scholars think that he did. And they actually think this increases historical veracity. I'll tell you why. The first step in all historical analysis is to work out how many different sources say roughly the same thing about a person or an event in the past. The more sources there are, the more confident we are of creating a portrait of a figure or an event. This is called, I'm sorry to say, the criterion of multiple attestation. Did we really bring him across from Australia to tell us this? When numerous sources independently offer roughly the same portrait of an event or person from the past, that portrait takes on greater plausibility. That's the criterion of multiple attestation. But it's actually common sense. You use it every day. If you hear some very bizarre news from one friend, you may or may not believe it. It depends on whether you trust the friend. But if you hear the same bizarre news from two different sources and you know they haven't just got together to wind you up, you're likely to believe it. What if you hear it from three or four or five or six different sources that haven't been copied from one another? You apply the criterion of multiple attestation. You're just not pretentious enough to call it that. The fact that the New Testament is a collection of sources rather than a single source from a single hand actually enhances historical reliability. Fifth, the New Testament evidence is early evidence. You often hear people say, oh, the New Testament is written, you know, hundreds of years after Jesus. How could you possibly trust it? Well, that's not quite the case, actually. Let me offer you three comparisons. The earliest biography of Muhammad, the founder of the Islamic faith, was composed around the year 760. That's 125 years after Muhammad's death. The first biography. And it was edited for another 50 years. And then codified in what we now call the Sira, the official life of Muhammad. The first written records of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the first written records, come from 350 years after the Buddha's death. This is not just John Dixon making this up. This is what Buddhist scholars and Islamic scholars all agree upon. 350 years. Or to give a closer comparison, the most important source for the life of Emperor Tiberius, who ruled when Jesus lived, is Tacitus, who writes around the year 114. Now, if my maths is right, that's about 77 years. Let's call it nearly 80. Nearly 80 years after Tiberius is dead is our best source for his life from the hand of Tacitus. When you know that and you turn to the Gospels and the writings of the New Testament, it becomes pretty clear the New Testament is early. The last text of the New Testament, even if we have the dates of the secular critical scholars, would be the Gospel of John in the mid-90s, 65 years after Jesus' death. Hold that comparison in mind. The last text of the New Testament is still earlier than our best source for Emperor Tiberius. Now, I actually think the Gospel of John predates the 90s by a decade or more, but I'm even giving you the secular dating. Even on secular dating of the New Testament is early. What's more, we have the wonderful 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 5, in which all scholars agree Paul quotes a creed that predates him by two decades.
In this glass frame is the earliest example of Christian oral tradition. Here, the Apostle Paul reminds the Corinthians of a fixed summary of the Christian faith, which he passed on to them years earlier, and which he himself had received shortly after his conversion. Mainstream scholars date this summary to within months of Jesus' death. Hoti Christos apethenen huper ton hamation hemon katatas graphas. That Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures. Kai hoti etafe. And that he was buried. Kai hoti egergetai te hemera te trite katatas graphas. And that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. Kai hoti Uther Kepha Eta Tois Dodeca, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. These words were in common Christian usage before the year 35. Whatever else we may want to say about the basic plot of Jesus' life, it clearly wasn't a legend growing up over time. This fixed summary or creed provides evidence that the broad narrative of Jesus' death, burial, resurrection, and appearances was being taught and memorized decades before the details were written up in the Gospels.
He puts it so much better than I can. It's great. Thank you. That was actually one of the greatest privileges of my life, to handle the earliest copy of Paul's letters in Chester Beatty Library in Dublin. And I stupidly, this colonial boy, stupidly turned around to the curator and said, how much would this be worth? And he looked down his nose at me in British style. I love British people, but they do condescension better than anyone in the world. Looked down his nose and he said, we do not discuss such things. I come from a convict colony, you know, just be nice. Let me move to my final major point. Sixthly, then, archaeology confirms and coheres with the Gospels. Archaeology confirms and coheres with the Gospels. Right now, scores of digs are going on all around Israel, and in Galilee in particular, and some of them are uncovering beautiful things that are doing gospel studies a great service. Let me give you four examples. Two almost trivial ones, but I'm sure you'll find them fun, and two quite serious ones, and you won't find them fun. So how about that? There's a trade-off for you. In John's Gospel, chapter 5, verse 2, John refers to a pool of Bethesda in which there is this very strange design of having five covered colonnades, that is, five rows of columns over the pool. That's a bizarre design for a pool. But we had dug up all around Jerusalem, not me personally, but archaeologists, and not found this pool. And so some scholars started to doubt that it existed. Maybe it was a metaphor. Five. What else has five? First five books of the Old Testament, the Torah. Maybe it's a metaphor. And some people actually went into print saying that the five colonnades refers to the five books of the Old Testament. It's not a real pool. And then they dug slightly to the left. And they uncovered the pool. And there is still, to this day, the remains of five covered colonnades right in the very area of Jerusalem, John said, it would be all the time. Imagine being one of those scholars that went into print. Wouldn't you go into libraries and push your book to the back? Right? Now, you'd think they'd learned their lesson. But there's another pool, a few chapters later in John's Gospel, chapter 9, called the Pool of Siloam. Jesus sent someone there to be healed. We dug up all around what we thought was the Siloam district of Old Jerusalem and not found the pool. So, guess what? Some scholars actually went into print saying, the word Siloam in Aramaic means to send. Jesus sent the guy there to be healed. It's a metaphor. There never was such a pool. That was a little hasty. But then in June 2004, during some sewerage works here in the old part of Jerusalem, workers accidentally uncovered these steps, which led down to this amazing Jewish pool, definitively dated to the time of Jesus. To the embarrassment of some, it is without doubt the missing pool of Siloam. Isn't that fun? And to be able to play in the pool was really good. There was no water in it when I went there anyway, but gorgeous to find these things. But the important thing is that these finds are kind of trivial in one sense. Although they confirm minor details, they don't really cohere with the broad brushstroke of the Gospels. I want to give you two examples of archaeology that do. The Gospels give the very strong impression that Jesus' fellow Galileans, remember Galilee's up in the north of Israel, were deeply Jewish, deeply Jewish. You read the Gospels and it all looks very Jewish. But this was seriously challenged by a number of scholars 10 to 15 years ago. And they actually got together and called themselves the Jesus Seminar. And they produced books and started working on DVDs and so on. They believe that Galilee was pagan, not Jewish. That the Gospels get this wrong and we've found them out. And this is partly based on the fact that towns like Tiberias and Sepphoris in Galilee are built in Greco-Roman style. So that the buildings are shaped more like Greek and Roman buildings rather than traditional Jewish ones. And so they started to say Galilee was pagan. And of course, what they went to do is went through the Gospels and removed all the really Jewish sounding bits. Because they believed Jesus must have been influenced more by pagan philosophy than Judaism. So out went the kingdom of God, out went all the controversies over the Old Testament, out went the discussions of Jewish food laws, out went all the Jewish stuff, and left Jesus with just a few wise philosophical sayings. That was the theory. We haven't heard much from the Jesus Seminar in recent years, And one of the reasons is that archaeology has virtually sunk this theory forever. For the simple reason that recent archaeology of Galilee has found Judaism deep in the culture. Having pointy roofs in Greco-Roman style is one thing, but when you look down to the deep material culture of Jesus' Lower Galilee, it is Jewish through and through. How do we know? Limestone bowls are found everywhere. Only Jews who were interested in purity used limestone for bowls. The burial techniques we've discovered are all Jewish burial techniques. And here's the giveaway. In the rubbish dumps of most Greco-Roman towns, you find pig bones, because people loved pork. In the towns of Lower Galilee, no pig bones. Completely absent. Which tells you what? They're living kosher lives. Archaeology has demonstrated the deep Jewish influence of Jesus' home district. And what this does is it makes the Gospels look exactly like the archaeology says. My final archaeological example doesn't have to do with the historical Jesus as such, but with how the early Christians interpreted Jesus. The earliest church yet found was found just 5 years ago in Megiddo in the middle of Israel. And this is an incredibly important find because it now offers evidence that the early Christians worshipped Jesus as divine. Now, I know you and I just accept that because it's in our Gospels, but you know, don't you, that there are lots of people running around saying the idea that Jesus is actually God was an idea invented in the 4th century. Emperor Constantine invented it because he wanted a God figure to rule the empire. So he elevated Jesus from being a good Jewish teacher to being God. And so he called the Nicene Council, have you heard this stuff? Year 325, so 4th century, and told all the bishops they had to make Jesus God now, not just a man. Now, if that sounds familiar, I mean, it was in Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. Lots of skeptics say this. Jehovah's Witnesses have been saying this for years, that the idea that Jesus is fully God was just an invention of the 4th century. However, in this courtyard, in the middle of Israel, we've uncovered a house that has been renovated into a church that predates the Council of Nicaea, Emperor Constantine, by more than a century. And what do we find on the floor? Proof that these Christians were worshipping Jesus as God. Let me show you. Okay, so here in the corner of the mosaic, in this prayer hall, we have an inscription that tells us about a woman called Akeptus, who offered this table, a reference to the table in the middle, probably the table where communion was had, in memorial of the God Jesus Christ. So here, if the chief archaeologist's dating is correct, early 3rd century, we have a clear reference to Jesus as divine, almost a century before the Council of Nicaea, before Constantine. That was one of the greatest privileges of my life, to stand in what is still a live dig. They won't be finished with this dig for another 3 years. To stand on a mosaic where my brothers and sisters, centuries ago, long before Constantine, long before the Council of Nicaea, were worshipping Jesus as divine, as God embodied. A great privilege. Now, this doesn't prove that Jesus was God, right? All it demonstrates is that we know for certain Christians were worshipping Jesus as God long before the Council of Nicaea put it in the Nicene Creed. To conclude, all in all, we have exactly the kind of evidence you would expect if the Gospel's account of Jesus was true. And much more evidence pointing in that direction than you would expect if it wasn't. We have exactly the kind of evidence you would expect if the Gospel's account of Jesus was true. And much more evidence pointing in that direction than you would expect if it wasn't. This is why historians, even secular ones, take the Gospels seriously. But there's a final caveat I want to offer. And in some ways, it undoes everything that I've just said. Even though I love history, even though I teach history, history isn't everything. People don't turn to Christ and follow him, or turn away from Christ because of historical evidence alone. The great Greek philosopher Aristotle said people form their beliefs by three factors: an intellectual factor, logos, an emotional factor he called pathos, and a social factor called ethos. What he meant was, when we form our beliefs, we like to know that there's rational basis for it or some evidence. That's intellect. But at the same time, we are drawn to truths that meet our needs, that resonate with our deepest selves. That's pathos. And we tend to be drawn to things that work in life, in the social context. And that is ethos. He's right, isn't he? This is true of beliefs about climate change. I think you become a climate change believer or a climate change skeptic on the basis of all three factors: little bit of intellect, little bit of emotional resonance, little bit of social function. It's true of politics. It's true of faith as well. And Christians are usually very open about this. Christians, if you hear their story of coming to faith, will often say, you know what, there was some intellectual stuff I read that really convinced me that Christianity had a lot going for it. But they won't stop there. They'll say, and when I heard the message of Christ dying for my sins, that I could be forgiven and that he's alive to offer that forgiveness, then I felt myself drawn. That's pathos. Or they might say, I was so impressed by the Christian community that loved me, that set up a peace house and served the wider community, and I was drawn to that. That's ethos. But interestingly, skeptics rarely admit that their skepticism is formed on the basis of the same three things. People often claim that they don't believe simply because there's not enough evidence. I've spoken to enough atheists over the years to know that there are many atheists who claim it's all intellectual, but in the end you find out it's because they were mistreated by a Christian once, or they had a terrible church upbringing, or they've been disappointed in life and can't believe there's a God. The reason I'm pointing all of this out is simply to say, please don't think that what I've told you tonight about the six things you ought to know about the historical Jesus give you an entire reason to be a Christian. And if you're sitting there and thinking, oh, there's not enough evidence for me, I want to ask you to think, what are the emotional and social factors keeping you from faith? Don't fool yourself into thinking it is all about the intellect. The intellect is important. Evidence is real. But you've got to know yourself, your deeper motives, in order to really grapple with this stuff. Thank you so much.
Now, why is this subject so important? How can we know that we can trust the Bible? Because Jesus said this: if you continue in my word, that's the Bible, then you will know the truth, and the truth will... Most people are not free. They're enslaved to their past. They're enslaved to their habits. They're enslaved to fears. They're enslaved to the expectations of others. They're enslaved to the economy. They're enslaved to bitterness and they can't forgive somebody. They're enslaved to their own desires that they don't know how to change. There are things they don't like about themselves and they just can't change. Everybody is a slave to something. And Jesus said, when you know the truth will set you free. It's written across colleges all around the world. Now Jesus also said, I am the truth. He didn't just say, I point to it. He said, I'm it. He said it like this: I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, friend, that statement forces you to be on a dividing line one way or the other. You can't just be impartial about Jesus. The only thing Jesus cannot be is moderately important. Because if it's not true, if he is not the way, the truth, and the life, and he is not the only way to God, and if it is not his truth that sets us free, then we ought to just go home. And we ought to shut down every Christian hospital and every school, and the first school and the first hospital in every nation were started by Christians. Every single one. Why? Because we have a preaching, teaching, healing faith. Love God with your heart and soul and mind and strength. Love him passionately and intellectually and spiritually and socially. You love him in every area. So if it's not true, well, then there's no reason to even celebrate Christmas. Don't put up lights. Please, don't put up lights. Don't buy any presents. Because it really didn't happen. It really didn't happen. Jesus did not come and split history into AD and BC. What happened at Christmas? God invaded earth. And every time you write your birth date, you're using Jesus Christ as the source. What? Yeah. 1900 and so, 2000 and so, whatever. What are you talking about? You're talking about the years from Jesus, when God invaded earth. This is why it is a matter of life and death. If he is the truth, if he is the way, if he is the life, you owe him your life. There's no moderately important thing about Jesus. He's either a fake, phony, biggest fraud in history, or he's the God who created the universe, and you ought to worship him. You'll say, well, he's just a good man. Oh, really? If I were to stand up here and say, hi, my name's Rick Warren, and I'm a good teacher, you guys say, okay, I can buy that. If I stood up here and I say, hi, my name's Rick Warren, and I'm a godly man, you might say, well, I don't know about that, but maybe. If I said, hi, my name is Rick Warren, and I'm a prophet of God, some of you would bail at that one. And so you go, well, okay, maybe he really does speak words from God. But if I got up here and I said, hi, my name's Rick Warren, and I'm the Son of God, and I'm the only way to heaven, that kind of changes the situation. I'm either who I say I am, or I'm the biggest fake con man in history. I'm betting my life that the Bible is true. What are you betting your life on? All this weekend, you're going to hear five brilliant scholars from around the world. If you want to come back for all five, you can't. I'm just kidding. If you want to come back, you can. Come back to any of the services. They're all going to be speaking in different angles of this. Now, let me close by talking to three different groups. If this interested you, and you say, you know, I'd like to learn more about the Bible. I want to understand the Bible. I want to understand the truth that sets me free. And if you're not in a small group, then what you need to do is start planning right now, at the beginning of December, to invite a couple friends to form a little group with you and go through the 6-week video study that all 5,000 of our small groups are going to go through in January. If you're not in a group, we'll help you start one. And all you have to do is just take this bulletin, this program, and right here it says 40 Days in the Word, beginning January 21, I'll start a group. I'll get a couple of my friends. You just write your name and address. We'll get you all that information. We'll help you out. You're not in a small group. Now, if you're already in a small group, let me say this to you. We're going to be starting hundreds of new small groups to study 40 Days in the Word in January. And all of these new group hosts, they're going to need somebody to lean on. They're going to need a friend who, if they need to call somebody and go, what do I do now? You can answer. If you have been in a group longer than a year, and you would say, I'd be willing to be a friend, a guide, a coach, just a friend for another small group. I'm not asking you to start a small group. I'm asking you to be a friend of somebody who starts a small group. I'm going to have a dinner on Friday night, and I want to invite you to that dinner. And you need, if you say, I'm in a small group, but I'd be willing to help another small group that's a host who's getting started, you take this little flap and you write the word dinner on it. And then write, I'm hungry, underneath it. Rip that off and drop it in the basket, and that's your reservation. I'll send you the information for dinner with Rick on Friday night. Third group. If you've never gotten to know Jesus Christ, Jesus said this, anyone who wills to do the will of my Father will know if it is true. What's he saying there? He's saying, you're saying, God, I don't know if it's true or not, but I will to follow you. I will to make that decision. One day, a guy came to Jesus and he said, Lord, my daughter is sick and I need you to heal her. And Jesus looked at the guy and goes, do you believe I could heal her? Do you believe in me? Do you believe I can heal her? And the guy says this, Lord, I want to believe. I believe. Help me with my doubts. Jesus said, that's good enough. He healed her. Did you know you can say that to Jesus? Do you know that tonight you could say, dear Jesus, I want to believe. Help me with my doubts. And he'll say, that's good enough. Bam. And he will save you. And you will begin the freedom process in your life. Let's bow our heads. You say, you know, I've known about God. I've known about Jesus, but I've never really developed a personal relationship with him. Maybe you've been in church all your life, or this is the first time. I'm going to pray a little prayer right now, and just kind of an honest, gutsy prayer. And you pray this in your heart. You don't even have to say the words aloud. Say, dear God, I want to believe. Help me with my doubts. Dear God, I want to believe. Help me with my doubts. I want to know you. I want the truth to set me free. And I open up my life, God, to your truth. So as much as I know how, I say yes to you at this point in my life. And I pray this in your name. Amen.
We hope that you've been encouraged by this message. For a transcript and outline of this message or other resources, please visit saddlebackresources.com.